narrative of policing of black bodies. Join the conversation on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. To get a podcast or download past shows, log on to radioproject.org. I've been your host this week, Anita Johnson. Thanks for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good day. This is Lane Ponce, your host for Labor Radio on the fifth Monday. Today we have an interview going with a very prolific author who's written her ninth novel. She is here to talk about her new book called Unseen. And it's a continuation of a series that she started many years ago. And that is Susan Stoner, who's with us. Good evening, Susan.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm great. Glad to be here.
Tell me a little bit about this series from the beginning, moving up to your ninth novel.
Oh, okay. Well, I won't run through the storylines behind all nine novels, but basically, I was inspired to look at history from the perspective of what Howard Zinn would say is sort of the common, ordinary person. And what I discovered was that a lot of that history is missing, that most of the history that I got in school when I was growing up was, in fact, written by people of the upper class, white upper class, actually. So I decided to write stories that were entertaining, fast-paced, kind of adventure mysteries that have a labor movement operative, undercover operative, trying to achieve social and economic justice in the Pacific Northwest, and more particularly in Oregon and Portland. And so to do that, I started researching history, and each story centers on something that progressive people of the early 1900s were able to accomplish to change history and make it a better world for all of us. And it also helped to create the country's middle class. And for a while, it was the most vibrant and most progressive middle class in the world. Unfortunately, since Reagan, that's kind of changed.
So a slide
latest book is a little bit of a deviation because instead of doing labor issues, I focus on what happened with Native Americans in the United States in the early 1900s, what was going on, and sort of historically what happened, especially in Oregon.
And you actually were working when you first started this series. What kind of job did you have at that time?
Oh, at the time I was the in-house counsel, general counsel for the labor union.
A busy job, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
And yet you took time out to go do extensive research to write your books.
Yes, I found, as an attorney, you write a lot, but it's all nonfiction. Although the opposing counsel would say it was fiction, but anyway, you write a lot of nonfiction. I had never conceived, and when I was in college, I was very much into writing papers in lieu of tests. I love to write. So I'd never conceived of writing fiction, but I read about the Flying Squadron, which was a group of men who traveled the rails in the early 1900s. And what they did was there were railroad bulls on the railroad that would harm the hobos and the unemployed people who were having to ride the rails. And so when they found or heard of one that was particularly bad, they would get on the train and maybe take off their boots and make them walk from the countryside back to the station, things like that. They didn't kill anybody, but they really tried to bring some control and protection to the people riding the rails. Well, I thought that the people in the union I was serving needed to realize that was in their history and that they were, quote, standing on the shoulders of labor union people and that had made a lot of improvements. And so I decided to write a little story about that, and the first one has the Flying Squadron in it, and that's where it started. It's called Timber Beasts, and it was about people who worked in the woods and how they were treated and what that kind of life was like. So
you do a lot of research for your background of your stories. How does that, what kind of time do you put into that, and how does that look in your life when you're doing research?
You know, each book has been different. I wrote one that took place in Prineville, Oregon, and that one, it just so happened that I had some labor cases over there as an attorney. So I would stay extra days and research. They have a great little historical museum there and a good archive, and so I researched that there. Another time I had a lawyer's conference in Washington, D.C., and I stayed longer and did research there, and that research I used in the book about Teddy Roosevelt and an assassination attempt on him. So in San Francisco, same thing for a Shanghai book, which was Portland was a Shanghai capital of the West Coast, or actually the country. And but I was in San Francisco. They have a wonderful maritime museum and library there, and I researched that. So in a way, when I was working, a lot of my research I was able to fold into my work duties.
So that's what you did to relax from a kind of high-stress job?
Well, you know, the beauty about writing fiction is you get to decide what the outcome is going to be.
Yes. Not so with legal work, right?
No. It depends on a third party usually, and not always one that you really respect. So, yeah, so it was a wonderful way to relax and to live in an imaginary world that I was able to shape the way I wanted it. And the books are very, my hero, Sage Adair, is not a belly button gazing, troubled kind of person. He believes in working in groups, so he has a cadre of people that he works with, and sometimes they take the lead, sometimes they have the best ideas. And I think that's the way it is in real life, that I've discovered that whenever you have a problem, it's definitely people than if you're trying to come up with a solution on your own. So
right, and you have developed a group that's led by Sage Adair. Give me a little background on Sage and how he's able to maneuver his undercover work. And is he rich? Is he poor? What's this guy's background?
He was, his mom was an Appalachian woman. His father was also from Appalachia, but his father was a turncoat and worked for the mining operators and ended up, his actions actually ended up with Sage's grandfather and uncle being murdered by mine owner thugs. But when he was nine and working in the mines, because back then they had nine-year-old children working in the mines, there was an explosion, and he saved the mine owner's grandson. And because of that, the mine owner felt sort of grudgingly beholden to him and said that he would take him into his home and educate him, provided that his mother gave up any control over him and didn't see him. So he was raised in a wealthy family from nine on. He went to school, I think Princeton. Yeah, I think it was Princeton. And then struck out after college and went to Alaska and got there just as the gold rush happened, and was one of the early prospectors. Made a lot of money, brought it back to U.S., found his mother, and the two of them decided that they were going to work for labor unions. At the time, there was a strike going on in Appalachia, and she was working on it. So they bonded again, and then traveled in different parts of the country, but ended up in Portland. He opened a very fancy restaurant, which, by the way, I found out is kind of, I had developed this restaurant called Mozart's Table and then discovered later that there was actually a restaurant like that.
Yes.
It was a gathering place for John Reed and
all the rich
and
people,
Louise.
Rich and famous.
Yeah, all the rich and famous, but also progressive people. But in his case, he opened the restaurant because he wanted to get next to the rich in Portland and expose how they were exploiting people.
Well, that's kind of it really sounds more like you're talking about your favorite uncle rather than a fictional character. But you've been with him for nine books now, right?
Yes.
Yes. He's a very charming character. I've found him to be, it's always good to have a new book come out because it's like, oh boy, another visit from Sage Adair.
Yeah.
You're listening to KBOO and Lane Ponce, host for Fifth Monday, and I'm interviewing Susan Stoner, who has just finished her ninth book called Unseen, and we are discussing how to write books and other important things about how life is. So Susan, tell me, what do you know what you're doing next, or is that on hold?
You know, Unseen is about, the researching of Unseen was very painful and difficult, not because there wasn't lots of material, there is, and as every year that passes, more and more Native Americans are writing about their experience and about their history, so the research was good, but I was just horrified and appalled at really the harshness of their history and how exploited they were and are even now. So, in a way, I'm kind of trying to recover from that. So I'm not really sure what my next book or novel or story would be about. I'm thinking it might be about the impact of socialists on Oregon history, because there was a time in the early 1900s when there were a lot of socialists here. And as most people know, the Pacific Northwest is considered a bastion of liberal thinking or progressive thinking relative to other parts of the country. Having lived in the South, I know it is. But the question is why? Where does that come from? And I'm wondering, and I don't know the answer because I haven't done sufficient amount of research to know whether the fact that socialists were here and their concepts were pretty well communicated in the among the general population things like that. Some of them were very active in that. One of the books I wrote, Bitter Cry, had messenger service in it. And messenger services were very exploitative of kids, except for one. And that was run by a blind man, but he was he actually tried to make it a positive thing, and he invested in the future of his employees. Well, I didn't, in research, starting my research on socialism in this area, I discovered he, in fact, was a socialist and a utopian.
And he's a real person.
And he was a real person. And he wrote about it. And so I know that that one person, his model for his messenger service became the one that the city council in Portland adopted. All the rules and regulations and stuff. Like, for example, he would not allow his messengers to go into brothels or taverns because they were young boys. So, you know, that made me kind of curious. So how many other socialists were out there that we don't know about that were leading fights? Another example is Mayor Harry, well, he was the mayor and a senator, but Harry Lang, but he was first the poor people's doctor of Portland. Well, credit was given, it was interesting to find out that credit in the history was given to the fact that he had socialist sister and brother, and son and sister-in-law. They were socialists, and so everybody's saying, well, he was for the Indians because of these, you know, that relationship. Well, I read that, in fact, when he was growing up, he spent a lot of time with Kalapuya Indians. And the thing that I learned really strongly in this research for Unseen was that they were very much into communal relationships and putting the health of the community above individualism. So then Harry Lane deciding he's going to be the poor people's doctor before his son was even born, it is explained by the time that he spent with the Kalapuya Indians.
Tell me about your terminology, because you address this very, very well in your book. But you decided to refer to the tribes as Indians.
Yes.
And how did you come about that as opposed to Native American?
At the time, early 1900s, the term Indian was by far the most used. And even today, you know, you look at the most, quote, radical movement, the American Indian movement. They didn't say the Native American Indian movement or the Native American movement. They called themselves the Native American Indian movement. When you look at the tribes' names across the country, they tend to call themselves Indians. But there is conflict among them, just as there is among Chicanos, whether they want to be called Latinos or Hispanic or whatever, I mean, or Chicano, you know. So, but the most common term back then was Indian, and so that was the one that I used. My personal favorite is First Nation.
Canadians use that.
Yeah, which is used in Canada, and because the United States was not a wilderness to the people who lived here before Columbus.
There was a
they
First Nation.
They knew every rock, they knew every stream, they knew every animal. It was not a wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And they had geographically divided it up among Indian nations.
And there's so many.
Yes, there were so many. And so I just decided that Indian was probably the best way to go. And Aboriginal, I think that's a term that's, and indigenous are both things that are, you know, much more modern. They certainly weren't being used that early, you know, in the 1900s very commonly.
Right. So your books take place in 1900 to about what date?
I think I'm up to, my first one started in 1902, and this one is in 1904.
Okay.
So Sandy's a busy boy.
You've got 9 books that took place in 4 years, huh? Well, now you also talk about this era as being a progressive era that resulted in a lot of changes that were very positive. Do you reflect that onto our current time and difficulties now?
It's very much the same. most people have heard of the term Gilded Age, and Gilded Age was a time when there was a concentration of wealth and a gross economic inequality, and it was so bad that people rose up and said, enough is enough. I sound like Bernie, but it's true, enough is enough. And I think what's encouraging now is that the value system that people are developing, thanks to social media and the internet, is a worldwide value system. People who are in Belarus or people who are in Africa are saying the same thing that people are saying here. And in fact, when the Black Lives Matter movement and George Floyd was killed, there were demonstrations across the world and saying, hey, racism's here also. So in a way, it's very much the same. I think social justice and inequality are becoming a real problem. And I think that what the progressives did in the early 1900s was to change the world. And I think that that's now happening. So
you have a very nice sense of a positive approach to our era, when at times it seems like, how can it even be positive? But this comes out in your work. And the other thing I really admire about your books is you spend a lot of time explaining the historic significance of the particular book. Sometimes you have up to, 10 or 12 pages of background information?
Oh, yes.
Sometimes I cheat and read those first and then reread them after the story.
A lot of people do that. And the historical notes in this, I think, there's 64 different notes. I actually number them because I think it's easier to read than one long blah, 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 blah. And so I think that I can't put all the facts that I've discovered in the historical notes, but I try to put a goodly number so people can trust their reactions to the story.
No, it seems very, I know that I visited you one time when you were doing your research on this book, and your table that we're sitting at now was loaded with books. You had at least 100 books stacked up, so it would be hard to condense that into your historical facts at the back of your books.
Yeah.
Well, I think our time is coming to an end, and I would like to encourage everyone to listen to Labor Radio every Monday from 6 to 6:30, and I'm hoping that Susan will be back with me, because she's managed with her husband George to be able to get us to actually record at their home. So thank you very much, and please tune in every Monday, 6 to 6:30, KBOO's Labor Radio. Thank you. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You are listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. And we are very honored tonight to have Mingus Mapps on. Mingus is a candidate for city council here in Portland. And in order to respect FCC equal access laws, we will also be inviting Chloe Udaly on. Mingus, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here. I'm delighted to talk about this important issue.
It's great to have you on. And congratulations on your campaign. It sounds like it's going really well for you.
It's been a real journey and a ton of fun.